Hello, this is Chris Grimes, your host and curator of the Good Listening To show, Stories of Distinction and Genius. Before we get going with today's show, very excitingly, it's one of the live theatre show versions of the Good Listening To show, which is also available as an events, festival or theatre show, and one for an in-house show for clients to showcase your business too. So yes, have a look at www.thegoodlisteningtoshow.com. That's the new website for the show. And there are a number of series strands as to how you too can get involved. By being in the show, there are lots of business benefits too, because you get to reach a large global audience of about 1.3 million, care of my weekly show on UK Health Radio, which is broadcast globally across 54 countries. So yes, if you've written a good book, if you'd like to showcase your business, or if you'd like to host an in-house event with a difference, then the Good Listening To show is available as a live theatre or events show. Enjoy today's show. It's with Neil Malarkey from the Comedy Store Players, talking about his new book, In the Moment. And his was the second of two shows recorded live and with audience Q&A that evening. My previous guest had been Rosie Cavaliero, award-winning actress and comedian, who was actually defying the laws of physics by being in the show with me live that night, because as I was speaking to her, she was also going live on UK national television on BBC One with her new sitcom, The Power of Parker. Both shows were live streamed to Facebook and YouTube simultaneously, and there was a Q&A for both guests too. So yes, enjoy tonight's show. Neil Malarkey, Bar Theatre Royal, talking about his new book, In the Moment. Hurrah! Welcome to another episode of The Good Listening To show, your life and times with me, Chris Grimes, the storytelling show that features The Clearing, where all good questions come to get asked and all good stories come to be told. And where all my guests have two things in common. They're all creative individuals and all with an interesting story to tell. There are some lovely storytelling metaphors. A clearing, a tree, a juicy storytelling exercise called 5-4-3-2-1, some alchemy, some gold, a cheeky bit of Shakespeare, and a cake. So it's all to play for. So yes, welcome to the Good Listening To show, your life and times with me, Chris Grimes. Are you sitting comfortably? Then we shall begin. Ladies and gentlemen, min, and people on YouTube and Facebook, would you please say hurrah and we're here. Good evening. Marvellous. Wow. There is a rule in comedy improvisation where if you can't top it, stop it. So that's given us a bit of a tough task now. So that was a very, very jubilant beginning. Thank you. So welcome if you've just tuned in on Facebook and YouTube. Facebook, YouTube, YouTube, Facebook. Doesn't really matter. They're streaming in. There are billions of people down the old camera lens and hundreds of thousands of people here at the Bath Theatre Royal Ustinov Studio. Let's have another cheer, please. If you've not seen the show or heard the show before, where have you been? But it's the show in which I invite movers, makers, influencers, mavericks, personal heroes to a clearing or serious happy place of their choosing to all share with us their stories of distinction and genius. And with that imperative in mind, who is going to fit right into that beautifully? Would you please welcome my first guest of the two that we're doing this evening, if you'll pardon that particular expression. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please welcome the king of improvisation all the way from Londinium, Mr. Neil Malarkey. Again, that's not the end of the show. We've still got more to do.
Oh, right, okay.
So, good evening. Would you like a kiss or are you all right?
I'll have a glass of water.
Yes, decant some water.
Thank you.
Oh, you've done that already.
I got somebody to do it for me. Because whenever I do things on stage, speeches and stuff, I have a little rider, which is where you have, say, I want jelly babies and towels and stuff. And I always say, please can somebody pour the water for me? Because otherwise you're going...
Yes.
Especially if it's fizzy, poof, and it goes all over you can't, and you're trying to do, you know, urbane humour, and you're covered in water.
Yes, and well done. You've not covered yourself in water. All is going smoothly. So you're extremely welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
So I know you know who you are, but just to blow a bit of happy smoke at you, you're obviously an English writer and comedian and actor. And by the way, keep clapping, that's good. And when I Googled you, by the way, Rotten Tomatoes actually are talking about you rather sadly in the past tense. They're saying, was an actor who had a successful Hollywood career.
That's okay.
But I
don't do much acting these days. It's a lot of hard work. You have to wear makeup and everything and learn lines. So I sort of said goodbye to that. And then in 2021, we filmed a thing called The Pentaveret for Netflix, which was written, created by Mike Myers. People might have seen that on Netflix, The Pentaveret.
Yes, and indeed, Mike Myers was your alma mater, friend of old. You've been in, I think it's two of his films, obviously.
Austin Powers, the first one, International Man of Mystery, which I gave him the title. In The Stage, has anyone heard of The Stage? Yes. The Stage is the newspaper for people in show business. So occasionally there were adverts for actors, you know, do you want to go on a cruise for 3 years and get paid diddly squat? But there were also adverts for acts, mostly sort of show acts who might be on that cruise. And one was called Mr. Smith or something, brackets, International Man of Mystery. Not just Man of Mystery, International Man of Mystery. So I showed this to Mike, and he took it to be the title of the first Austin Powers movie. And I'm also in the third one in Austin Powers' Gold Member.
Gold Member. We're all going to sing that in a moment, obviously. So, yes, and Mike Myers was a co-founder with you of the Comedy Store Players, is my understanding. You have got the dream gig because you're in central London every Sunday.
Yes.
Without fail.
Without fail. Well, we did fail for a year and a bit because of you know what, beginning with Pan and ending with Demick. So the Comedy Store Players, in October, it will be 38 years we've been doing it. So Mike and I were doing a double act called Malarkey and Myers. Crazy title.
I like the billing there.
Yes, that's right. Myers, occasionally say Myers and Malarkey, but no, it was alphabetical, I think. And so the Comedy Store Players was founded by us two, Kit Hollebach, who'd worked with Robin Williams in San Francisco, and a guy called Dave Cohen and Paul Merton. Those three were doing a show at the same venue as us at the Edinburgh Festival in 1985, before most of you were born. And they said, oh, let's do some improv, because Kit had done it and it sounded fun. So the Comedy Store let us do Sunday nights. The other nights were stand-up, or actually they sublet it to discos, because comedy was still fairly... alternative comedy was fairly new in those days. And we've been doing it every Sunday ever since, really, apart from that break because of the you-know-what.
The thing beginning with P and ending in...
Yes. So Mike was there in 85. By summer 86, he went back to see his family. His father was not well, and also he was offered the chance to join the Toronto main stage of Second City Theatre Company, having been in the Taurine Company. We may get onto this for a while. Chris tends to ask me one question. I could finish an hour and a half later.
Marvellous.
But Second City was the improv troupe in North America.
Yes.
And Mike taught us improv, the same sort of improv he'd learnt in Toronto with Second City.
And if I may, I'm sort of following, if you'll pardon this particular expression, in your slipstream, because I'm part of Instant Wit, which has been going back 10 years. We've been going for donkey's years, like 30 years now. And in fact, my co-director, Stephanie Weston's in the audience this evening. Marvellous. But we're 10 years behind you, and you were always the sort of, the pinnacle of, wow, that's the Comedy Store. And I've seen you at least three or four times in that venue.
We're very lucky that we still have this venue. There can't be many performers who've got a guaranteed gig once a week for nearly four decades. It's incredibly lucky. Also, we're very lucky because we invite the most brilliant performers to come play with us. So Greg Proops was in town the other day. You might remember him from Whose Line Is It Anyway. He dropped in, and it's people who are much younger than us are happy to come and muck about with their codgers. And it's an incredible privilege to be able to stand on stage for 2 hours, say the first thing comes into your head, and get paid for it.
Indeed it is.
So it's a bit like Whose Line Is It Anyway, but there's no Clive Anderson and there's no editing. Or TikTok, and they have improv on it, TikTok, where the audience gives suggestions and we act it out there and then. It's a wonderful form of theatre, which before I'd been in it, I couldn't believe could actually work.
Yes.
2 hours with no script. No, it's a cheat.
That's a new format you've done then, if you're doing it on TikTok as well.
I haven't. Young people do
Young people.
We film some of our bits.
Yes, I'm sure you do.
and put sort of TikTok-friendly segments.
Have a go on my Tinder, by the way. This will make you feel
Is that right? Oh, I say.
That was quite
so we do that, but there are people, my niece, of course, who's actually a doctor in her 20s, said, oh, she watches quite a lot of improv on TikTok. So it's young people trying different ways of just improvising in the street and so forth. So it's a really wonderful form of expression, really, to do things that have very little prep.
And you're pushing on an open door, because I love improvisation too. And we can't obviously pass much of the evening with noticing you've written a book as well, which we're going to need to talk about.
Have I really? I happen to have a copy. Yes. In the moment. In the moment.
Yes. And you're doing a lot in the corporate arena, which is what we'll get you to talk about too.
Yeah. Well, actually, about the turn of the century, I was beginning to think, oh, what am I going to do with my life? And actually, it's getting the sense that theatre and art could have something to say that to people who had jobs in organisations. And improv is all about listening, working together. I don't know what I'm going to say. I don't know what you're going to say, but together let's co-create something. Nobody's got sole responsibility, but we both share the joy of where it'll go. And that is a very applicable skill. And little did I know how applicable it was. It's interesting because actually Bath has many memories for me, because I was thinking of coming to Bath Business School to learn how to do business, to do an MBA, the Master of Business Administration. And one of the professors there said, oh, hello, aren't you the Neil Malarkey I saw doing improv at the Bath Fringe years ago? I said, yeah. And she said, why do you want to come here? And I said, I think I better need to know about business before I can teach business people improv. And she said, really? Do you? Such of a good question.
Yes.
And I talked to her. I talked to her former boss, who had been a drama lecturer before becoming a business lecturer, then had retired. And he said, oh, no, you don't want an MBA. You'll talk like them. And he said, management is easy.
That's quite Alan Bennett-y.
It was, yes, it was. I think he came from Yorkshire. But he said, management is easy. Have a plan. Communicate it. And that's
and
very simple.
Collectively saved you tens of thousands of pounds. Yes.
Well, I did say, Ian, please recommend me some books. And so I read about 10 books to understand a little bit about how what I thought was helpful, because improv is about dealing with difference, uncertainty, where's it going to go? What's the custom going to think? Suddenly they do different things. Suddenly the government changes the regulations. Suddenly new technology comes in and that thing now works differently. You're all the time working with uncertainty. So to have that mindset was helpful. And also every conversation you have is a bit improvised, isn't it? Mm. There's no script, is there? If there were, it'd be quite a dull conversation.
It's like this, our thinking unfold as we go along.
Yes, Ian Forster, I think, said, I don't know what I think until I see what I write. Mm. So much of our life is improvised, but most communication training is scripted. How do you present? That kind of stuff. Anyway, I've leapt ahead.
So look, let's get you on the open road then, of letting me curating you through the structure and the storyscape of the Good Listening 2 show. So there's going to be all the usual lovely stuff. There's going to be a clearing, there's going to be a tree, there's going to be a juicy storytelling exercise called 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. There's going to be some alchemy, some gold, some storytelling apples. How do you like these apples? And there'll be a cake and some Shakespeare at the end too. So let's get you on the open road. So where is a clearing for Neil Malarkey? Where do you go to get clutter-free, inspirational and able to think?
Well, you have asked me this question, and I thought I'm going to give two answers. This may well be not allowed, but there's a place, which is the Comedy Store stage, when I'm on stage with my fellow Comedy Store players, and we're in flow. The audience gives suggestions, and we are taken hold by the whims and the gods of improv. We're in flow, the muse comes. It's wonderful. That's a very busy, crowded environment, 400 people on stage, in the audience, six on stage.
it's
kind of busy and indoors. On the other hand, just getting the train here today from London to Bath, I realised how much I adore the English countryside. So I love being in the mix with lots of people performing, having a crowd, bouncing off other people. But I also love solitude. I think especially since lockdown, when solitude was quite difficult to find sometimes. I just like walking on my own. As I got older, just walking and not having to get somewhere on time. I remember sometimes when I used to do, I do quite a lot of international work, and in those days, when you went to New York, your phone wouldn't work because you didn't have coverage.
Yeah, I remember.
And now you can. And it was just lovely to think, nobody can get me.
And you're off to Zambia tomorrow, and you...
Yes.
You said that the dream is that you've got 3 days of...
Well, it's not such a dream now, because, of course, what's going to happen with, you know, my aged in-laws and my own mother. So that's a bit worrying. But it will be nice to be not having to answer to timetables.
Yes.
I quite like that. I like just walking and thinking I don't have to be anywhere for an hour or two or half an hour or 3 hours. But I particularly love the English countryside. I used to live in Sussex, and my heart just lifts looking out of the window as I see that particular stone that you have on the way here, those little villages, that Cotswoldy look. So I like that as well. I like the solitude, and I like being busy. And dare I say, this could be many of the answers, the paradox.
Yes.
That I couldn't do without this, and I occasionally seek out that.
And there's that lovely Nietzsche quote, if in doubt, walk it out. So I think it relates to the idea of being outside.
Well,
walking.
Actually, absolutely. St. Augustine, I think, said something like, no problem can't be solved by a walk.
Ah, we've gone all intellectual. That's lovely.
What do you mean, gone? I always was, darling.
So then we've got, I'm going to turn up with a tree now.
Yeah.
So it's either going to be in your train carriage or on a walk.
Yes.
Or on the Comedy Store stage.
It's like a tree. So let's go with the clearing in a wood. Bluebells on the floor, and it feels like nobody's around except for you, me, and the 1,000 people we have here.
Lovely.
And everyone at home.
Yes, don't forget the Facebook and YouTube people as well. So, yes, I'm now going to arrive with a tree, a bit Waiting for Godot-esque existentially,
yes.
And I'm going to shake a tree to see which storytelling apples fall out. I've already said this, but how do you like these apples? Would you like an apple to clutch as we go through
okay.
this?
Think of it. It's a little bit like the poison apple in Snow White, isn't
don't
it?
Don't eat it. It's a prop.
It is a prop, isn't it? Although one of my favourite things...
Yep.
Did you remember, there's a scene in Laurel and Hardy where there's some wax fruit and he starts eating it. That's Stan Laurel. And Oliver Hardy can't believe it, but Stan's quite enjoying the wax fruit. But I won't eat it.
Yes, he's my all-time comic hero, Stan Laurel. I know exactly the secret.
He is mine.
Well, snap. Do you want a high five? No, we'll do a high five later.
A virtual one.
A virtual one. So, yes, I'm now going to arrive then to take you through the 5-4-3-2-1, which is 5 minutes to have thought about 4 things that have shaped you, 3 things that inspire you, 2 things that never fail to grab your attention, and that's borrowed from the film Up, where some random squirrels are going to come in. Squirrels, don't throw the squirrel in yet. And then a quirky or unusual fact about you that we couldn't possibly know until you tell us. So how would you like to interpret the shaking of your canopy, or canopy, Neil Malarkey?
I'd like my canopy to be shaken. Are there canopies? Don't you like a bit of finger food?
I love a bit of finger food,
yes.
A finger buffet.
So are we doing the four things?
Yeah, 4 things that have shaped you.
Four things that have shaped me. I can't get away from my family, and I don't want to. My family, they shaped me. My school friends shaped me. My college friends shaped me. And this thing, improv theatre, which I've done for nearly 4 decades, has definitely shaped me, both on stage and off.
Lovely, lovely answers. So that's the 4 things really concisely. Any of
yep.
those you want to go into a bit more depth on?
Yes, if you like. So my family, I've got a mum, a dad and 2 brothers. And they have always been very supportive. My father has passed away now. And he always said, study at school and then university, something you love. Don't think you've got to get a job. And so I took him at his word. So I did maths, physics, chemistry, A-levels. Because I thought I'd be a doctor. But then I was in the school play in the lower sixth. The school play. And I smelt the joy that we're experiencing now. The audience, laughter. And that's what I wanted to do. And then I was in the play the next year. And I wanted to be in the Cambridge Footlights. So the Footlights yes. is where Monty Python, Stephen Fry, Hugh Laurie, Olivia Colman, Sacha Baron Cohen, many, many, Emma Thompson, many famous writer, performers, and others. So I got to be president. And by the second year of my university, I'd gone away from maths, physics, chemistry. I was studying economics because I had to do something before my dream, which was to study social and political science. I wanted to study the thing about how people react and interreact as individuals, as groups. I love how we become who we are, how we're shaped, and then how groups work together or don't. Mm. So I did social science social psychology, how children become who they are. There was a paper which I couldn't resist called Deviance.
Excellent.
Deviance, which was basically about how society, others, certain people, other risers. If you're not in the mainstream, how do we see you? And of course, in the 1980s, that was different from how it is now. But there was an essay, for example, on is there such a thing as a criminal personality? Is there? Are we all doomed to have no self?
This is a rhetorical question.
Free will. Yes. But you know, are we all just prisoners of our past? Anyway, so my father said, "Do you want to do this?" Yes, I do want to do showbiz, Dad. I do. And he said, "Okay, do it." Whereas my brothers, one was a chemical engineer, one was an accountant, very proper jobs. And it was funny because soon after I graduated, I was on the dole. Is it called that anymore? Supplementary benefit, income support. Not very much money, but more than they get now. And my rent was paid, which is unthinkable now, perhaps. Anyway, so I heard my mum on the phone to one of the family friends. Oh, yes, Neil. Neil, yes, he's trying to break into show business. And I remember she asked him, what are you going to do? Because I was thinking, oh, it's easy, just go to Edinburgh and get on Radio 4, easy.
Piece of cake, yes.
And, you know, eventually that did kind of work. And she thought, are you going to just send off applications to those adverts in the back of the stage? They need dancing girls on a cruise to Norway.
Perfect casting.
C'est moi.
Yeah.
In fact, one of my friends had got a job as assistant director of the Belgrade Theatre in Coventry. And they said, come on, audition for the Panto. Panto, yeah, funny, funny, buttons, I can do that. It was an audition for the chorus.
Oh.
So it was first thing, so we all, looking around, everyone's in leg warmers and stuff, and then on come this choreographer. Now, first of all, we do a bit of this, and she was saying words I didn't understand. There were obviously choreographed moves, and I let myself out gently, and my friend said, oops, I got it wrong.
So a life in pantomime was not for you?
Was not for me. So that's my family. They've always supported what I do, been slightly mystified by it. My school friends, that's when I realised laughter was wonderful. We laughed a lot. Monty Python, we still laugh without even really saying much now.
Yes.
That's when I became a little bit of who I am now, opening up my eyes to where the world is, perhaps some of my values and my sense of humour for sure. My college friends, so I had some college friends in my college, and I had some Footlights friends as well, all of whom have shaped who I am, my sense of humour, and just this, again, when I'm with my college friends, it's just I don't have to be anything other than who I am, which I'm still trying to find, but I know I'm that person that I was then, even though I'm fatter, older, and greyer, and I feel very much at home with them, and something about that period in your life it forms who you are. Mm-hmm. Later on, perhaps I'll talk about how we do develop, but those are the things. And then this thing came along. Mike Myers was selling tickets for a show. Mike Myers, I should say, was selling tickets for a show I was in. The ex-Cambridge Footlights, we'd gone on tour to Australia, came back. We're now a year out of Cambridge, so next year's lot could use them, the name Cambridge Footlights. So that's Steve Punt, Hugh Dennis, Nick Hancock. Mm-hmm. So we put on our poster, ex-Footlights, and we're playing a tiny theatre in Notting Hill, and there's a bloke selling tickets for us. He's in a wheelchair. Not because he's a wheelchair user, but because we'd use all the proper chairs on stage. We thought it'd be funny why the audience was coming in to be eating crisps and stuff like that. It wasn't really. They just thought we were odd. Anyway, so he was selling, and he was Mike Myers. Now, in 1985, he wasn't anybody famous. He'd done pretty well in Toronto, done child acting, and he'd been in Second City, and he had a character called Wayne, who at that stage came from Scarborough, which is a not very glamorous suburb of Toronto. Years later, he'd moved him to Chicago, Aurora. Anyway, so Mike made me laugh. Mike Myers. I hope some people too young here. Shrek, Austin Powers, Wayne's World.
Great connections.
There you go, exactly. Because even Shrek now is a bit old hat, although I can reveal there's a new Shrek on its way soon.
And is he going to voice Shrek again?
Yes, he is.
Of course
he is. Anyway, so Mike and I did a double act. First of all, I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm writing sketches. 1985, I said, nobody's doing sketches. It's all alternative comedy, stand-up, punchy, political. And then I took him to see some stuff, and I said, let's do some stuff. And we did sketches, which were very well received because they were quite different and energetic. And other comedians liked us because we weren't treading on their toes, I think. And we looked like we wanted the audience to have a good time rather than to hector them. And so then he was talking a lot about what he'd learnt with Second City, this improv thing, which actually, just to digress for a moment, improv, this thing where the audience gives suggestions to the actors, didn't start with performers. certainly didn't start with comedians. It started with a social worker in the 1920s in Chicago. And she was helping children. They were a bit shy. Perhaps they were disadvantaged. Perhaps they weren't even native speakers. She created exercises to give them the confidence to speak up. And it was her son who said, wow, these exercises could work as a form of theatre in their own right. So by 1959, he'd created Second City Theatre Company in Chicago. Second City, because Chicago is the second city of America, I guess. And he told me about the ethos of this improv. It was all about treating what the other person says as an offer, to accept the offer. Yes, and if I say, good morning, Mr. Johnson, you're Mr. Johnson. And you say, good morning, Mrs. Johnson, or good morning, Mr. Squirrel, or would you like this table? And the reg, you know, egg and bacon, whatever. So you'd, and oh, yes, I'll have egg and bacon. So you gradually build up the scene together. And Del Close was one of the founders of this thing in the 1950s. And he was talking very much about how we co-create, how we collaborate. And so you can imagine somebody in an improv scene wants to write the whole thing. And he said, don't do that. Bring a brick, and together we will build a cathedral. That sense of collaboration through the uncertainty, all we know is that we're doing it together, really affected me. As well as going on an improv workshop for a couple of weeks with Desmond Jones, the Desmond Jones School of Mime. He taught, I think he taught lots, Greystoke as a movie taught people playing gorillas how to move. In fact, I know Tarzan, because Tarzan had been brought up by gorillas. Anyway, he'd also worked with Keith Johnston, who was one of the gurus of improv here in the UK. Yeah. At the Royal Court is a writer's theatre, but in the 70s, Keith Johnston said, we can make much better theatre without writing. Yeah. So I learned in that time some improv. Mike was talking a lot about how we endow somebody with something. So if I say, Chris, it's great that you got out of jail, that's yes. A scene. There's a story there. Yeah. Rather than going, hello, who are you? What's going on? Mm-hmm. And also things like, there's a squirrel. Ah, a squirrel, what's going on? Ah, is more fun than squirrel. Look.
Can I just commend you for the bring a brick and we shall build a cathedral. I thought that was lovely.
I know. I have said it virtually every week since I read it. And it makes me tingle every time because I'm not good enough on my own. I've done some stand-up. I find it very lonely. But also I find in life... I'm not good enough on my own, and there's nobody from whom I cannot learn. Having children as well, my goodness, they teach you things, but people of all ages and, dare I say, educational achievements can teach you so much, whatever their story is. So anyway, where was I? Improv, this thing that Mike introduced me to, we formed the Comedy Store Players, we did it for years, and have done it for years. It became the thing I really wanted to do more than anything else. I did have a sort of moment on our 10th anniversary in 1995 where I was always the one who used to book who's on, make sure there's six people on, and I got a bit tired and I thought, I was also feeling a little bit fed up because I could see that spending, we used to do Wednesdays as well, 2 hours on a Wednesday, 2 hours on a Sunday, doing stuff that then gets forgotten, fluffy, frivolous improv. There's other people at home spending those 4 hours writing novels. It's film scripts, theatre. Why wasn't I doing that? So I said, I'm going to leave. I'll stop. Make use of that time better. Paul Merton took me for lunch and said, don't leave. You love it. Take 3 months off. So I said, all right. 3 months off. After 6 weeks, I was ringing up saying, has anyone dropped out? Maybe I could come.
So you had an improv sabbatical.
I had a sabbatical.
Yeah.
And actually... the moment for me was realizing, not that I'd spent too much time doing improv, I hadn't spent enough. And that was the moment where I realized, actually, I want to do more improv, and the way to do that and to teach this beautiful art form, which was all about vulnerability, all about dealing with failure and not knowing, all about sharing, spread that to beyond the stage. These skills can work off stage. They indeed started off stage with a social worker, giving people chance, young people chance to feel they could contribute. Mm. And that has been...
I really hadn't appreciated that. It had come from the 1920s, actually. That was something new to me.
Yeah. Yes.
Wow. We could now be then, please, onto the three things that inspire you. So, three things that inspire you.
Three things. I'm going to get cheap by saying people, because I, I'm inspired. Three things. I'm going to say Andy Smart,
yes,
formerly of the Comedy Store Players, he died of a heart attack. And this is where I have to have my glass of water. 2 months ago. He was such a funny man. Such a funny man. And just full of life. Full of life. He ran with the bulls in Pamplona. You know that thing somewhere, in Derbyshire, where they play football for about a day with a massive ball, about 300 people, over a river? He'd turn up every year and commentate on TalkSport for it. That thing where they roll a cheese down in cheddar and people get really badly injured.
He'd always be tanking and, along.
But he'd be saying, yes, I'll be there. He ran with the bull about bulls about 50 times. One time he's in a restaurant, he ordered oysters for starters. What do you want for your main course? Oysters. What do you want for your pudding? Oysters. So by the end, he had 48, and the patron came out and said, if you can eat two more, i.e. 50, I'll give you them for free. And he ate 50 oysters, and the whole restaurant applauded him. He was a funny, funny man, and he wrote a book called Hitch in Time, which is about how he decided to hitch around Europe in his sort of the period where he was sort of leaving university, becoming a comedian. And it was all about, he dreamed of being a comedian. Now, for me, the Cambridge Footlights was fairly easy. People had done it before. We used to sell out at the Edinburgh Festival. He went not to Cambridge. He started on the street. He was part of the Vicious Boys, who then won Best Street Act in London in 1984. So he inspired me because he would, and at his funeral, he'd written some notes to his children that they'd found, which was, and many of them were just wonderful, recommending bars across the world. But one was just say yes and then find out how to do it. Just made me laugh. He never failed to make me laugh on stage. So that's Andy Smart. And indeed, I could say all the Comedy Store Players, really, and our guests. The other one, or two more. One is Frank Farrelly, who is the father of provocative therapy. So when I was in this period of thinking comedy, improv, could bring more to life than merely the hours or two we spend in the theatre, what about the rest of your life? Comedy, I've always thought comedy is a unifying force when done right, which is mostly, aren't I rubbish? Anyone else rubbish? Yeah, me too. Rather than, look at him, he's not in our gang, he's a deviant. He's not in my gang, so I can laugh at him. That's othering. That's bullying. That's what they call disaffiliative humour. Affiliative humour is, we're all in this together. Crikey, how are we going to do this? Oh, we did that, didn't we? We were a bit rubbish, but we were okay. Bringing people together. So Frank Farrelly, I went along to a day at the Comedy Store. I'd seen a poster. They're going to have a day about the theory and science of comedy. So there were sociologists, psychologists, neuroscientists, and there was Arnold Brown, who was one of the comic strips. So in the 80s, there was the comic strip. Alternative comedy, Rick Mayall, Jennifer Saunders, Dawn French, Aid Edmondson, and this 50-year-old accountant from Glasgow.
Arnold Brown, yeah.
Arnold Brown. And his catchphrase was, why not? Why not? If there's anything you don't understand, then assume it's intellectual. Things that I've got a cult following me. I've got a cult following. At the moment, it's the Jehovah's Witnesses. So he supported Frank Sinatra once at the Glasgow, grief. You know, whatever, Ibrox Park.
We've all done this, yeah.
So Arnold, there was a note saying he joined up with a doctor, a proper doctor, to kind of look at how comedy and health were related. And I wrote to them and said, can I play? And so we became the Academy of Laughter and Health. Dr. Brian Kaplan, who's a GP and a homeopath, but he called himself Dr. Fishhead because he had a fish like that and a tie made of fish. And Arnold Brown. We were called the Academy of Laughter and Health. We did two gigs. One was at the New End Theatre in Hampstead, a former mortuary. And the other one was at the Freud Museum, which was where Sigmund Freud ended up in London in Hampstead. But then Brian Kaplan, the doctor, said, this guy I met the other day, he does provocative therapy. And he played me a cassette of Brian being interviewed by Frank. And there was a moment of transformation. Provocative therapy, Frank Farrelly was a professor of psychiatry, And he worked especially at Madison, Wisconsin, in North America, Mendota State Mental Hospital. So really severe cases, murderers, suicide watch, just people with, you know, they were had to be locked up for their own safety. And he had hitherto studied a thing called client-centered therapy, Carl Rogers counseling, which was just for the funsters here, which is, I can only understand you if I put myself in your shoes. Put myself in your shoes, understand why you feel this way, and you can see that's an ethical way, empathizing. But there was one Friday, he was a bit tired, and he was talking to this client, and the client was going, yeah, my life is rubbish, it's terrible. And Frank went, oh, shut up. You'll never get out of here. And the client went, yes, I will. And it was the first time the client had gone with something authentic and assertive and actually lifted their body. And he thought, I'm onto something. So he experimented with things like, you want to give up smoking? Oh, no. You want to smoke more. You should be smoking more. That's the trouble. And the client goes, what? Do I want to give up smoking? And his whole ethos was, the client has it within them. The answer is within them. And all I'm doing is teasing out what the answer is. I'm satirizing their self-limiting beliefs. And people would say to him, how do you become a provocative therapist? Because there'd be other things like, I want to give up smoking. Oh, no, you'll never do it, mate. Don't bother. And so there are various interventions.
So calling out that you're a loser.
Exactly. Yeah. And also there's research says that people like, you know, with your name will never give up smoking. Your name's Chris? No. You can't. There's some research. And they go, what? And it was, the whole thing was to kind of, he said, holding up a hall of mirrors to make them really think about and feel. And you could see when, and I went to see him, and I went all the way to see him because my literary agent said, I can sell a piece in the paper. I wrote a piece and they didn't sell it. But I met Frank and his wife, and he was just fascinating. And he described it as teasing people back to mental health. Provoke means provoke for the voice.
Yes.
Help them find their voice. And of course, it might look like you're bullying them, but you're not. You're doing it, and he always describe it as with open heart chakra. and a twinkle in your eye, because you have a contract. In fact, what you do is you do it for this period, and then you stop, and then say, how did that feel?
Yes.
And so he would do this in front of therapists and executive coaches, and somebody would volunteer, and then they'd film it and stop it and say, how did you know? What did you notice? And so the person could then talk about the process.
Yes.
And I was absolutely thrilled by this, because I'm teasing people back to mental health. Seem to be a
and
wonderful.
Are you chronicling that in this book as well?
I do mention about it, yes. I do, and I use it in my work.
Yes.
Things like just gently, if people say, I can't do this, I might say, well, you can't do it yet. And then tell me about the thing. And then I said, you've just done it, you idiot. You've just done it. What are you talking about? Who's that person you're pretending to be? Mm. So just gently realizing that they may have a script internally that may not be actually the one that's helping them. So yes, I talk about it. I talk about Frank in the book, definitely, because that was, first of all, opening my eyes to the possibilities of improv beyond the stage.
Yeah.
And secondly, I went to see him in the Netherlands, and there were lots of coaches there. I mentioned them before, executive coach. I'd heard of coach, football, basketball.
Yes.
But there are now coaches in business. I didn't understand what that was, but then I realized that this was just part of what was going on. People in business were looking outside to coaches, but also to people in the theatre and the arts to say, how can we use what you do so successfully to help us?
Because it's a profound suite of transferable skills that are incredibly
completely
powerful.
Transferable. This was one of my things I heard on the radio. Somebody from Ashridge Business School, which I'd heard of, which is near London in I was going to say near Luton, but that would be wrong. It's north of London. Anyway, he said, theatre is this place where matters psychological, emotional, and mental come together. Mm-hmm. And that's, I thought, yeah, that's right. So I wrote to him and said, can I come play? And I got a gig at a business school. I know you work there as well, but it's a proper business school. Mm. And they allowed...
And that got you on the open road and on the path of opening up like a front.
That was one of those things where I said, oh, I can do this, actually. Yeah. I'm allowed into this, the temple of business, or business training. And gradually, Other leads came. Somebody approached my voice agent to say, hey, Neil seemed funny in the Comedy Store. We're pitching for the Visa account, you know, Visa credit cards. Mm. Can he come in and do 20-minute stand-up comedy on credit cards? Luckily, my voiceover agent, I don't know why they approached her rather than somebody else, said, you can't just magic stand-up comedy out of nowhere, especially on one topic. But Neil, and I talked to her about my process of, I think this is what I want to do, and she said, Neil looks now to teach improv to people in business. Mm. There was a management consultancy. My wife was at a hen night, sitting next to somebody who was in communication for a management consultancy. Yes. And she said, yeah, that's a great idea. Because before, we've had people come in who are actors, who are teaching you how to project and everything. Trouble is, when you're a management consultant, the audience is tough. You know, you need to improvise. They're heckling you. They may not be throwing things at you, but no matter how well you project your sonnets in Shakespeare, they're asking, so what, mate? What about this thing you haven't
thought
about?
You can't just turn up in a cravat and expect them to be impressed.
Exactly. Or with a whole pack of stuff, they do that. Whole, here's the answer to everything.
Yes.
And the client goes, well, what about this? And they go, well, that's not in the pack. Let me talk about this.
And it links beautifully to the provocateur idea, because you go in as an outsider, almost like a maverick, an outlier, as I do, where you sort of get in there.
You're an outsider. You don't know the rules, or you pretend not to. And I can say, well, the boss clearly is an idiot, aren't they? Clearly, that's the problem. Just get rid of them. And they're going, well, no.
Yes.
Or,
yeah, call it out.
The thing is, you know, marketing are all, immoral people. Sales are even more immoral. That's the problem. And they're going, well, no, actually. And I said, well, why can't you talk to each other and realise that you're all in one team? Mm. That kind of thing, sort of holding up sort of silly stereotypes of different jobs and functions to say, well, what's really going on here? Mm. And how easy it is, for example, for people in a job to say, well, of course, every meeting we do is rubbish. It's all his fault, you know, it's all their fault. And I'm saying, well, why is it? You're in the system, you're in that improv scene, deal with it. Mm. You've got something to do. What was it
and
you
the
said?
The whole world is always improvising because all making this set up
you,
as we go
You
along
said
anyway.
Before we came on, I don't know if the audience at home heard it, which is if you can't top it, then stop it. But why are you in a meeting that everyone knows is a bit rubbish? Why don't you take some responsibility rather than that very and realize this is where provocative therapy came in, which is it's very, very comfortable to sit back and say, well, of course, I can't change anything. It's somebody else's fault.
It's sometimes called bystander syndrome, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where you think somebody else is listening, they'll sort this shit out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And of course, I'm much happier spending all my energy slagging it off behind their back. That's a much more comfortable place than saying, crikey, could I do something here? My third inspiration is Professor Herminia Ibarra. Herminia Ibarra, like, I suppose. She is a Cuban-American professor of business at London Business School. I say her just because she's a very clever person. She was at INSEAD, which is a French business school, the one where I applied. When I was thinking about doing an MBA, I applied to Bath, I applied to INSEAD. INSEAD was, you know, one of the top ones in the world, as good as Harvard, I think. And they turned me down flat, because you had to write essays. And I was writing essays saying, I want to make the world a better place. I want to use my communication skills to enhance understanding of humankind. You know, maybe I could work for the United Nations. And somebody said, you idiot. They want you to write, I want to be the chief executive of Hewlett-Packard. I want to run my own business. I want to be running a business of £45 billion. And so she was at INSEAD, and then I met her at a party in London, and she was moving to London Business School, and she was just so open and kind. Now, she's a proper researcher. She's written proper books and is in demand across the world. And I say her just because she's invited me to talk at London Business School, and is very open to people who are not academics like her.
Yes.
And she speaks such sense. And she talks about working identity. And in your working life, you're not the same person all the time. Mm. And she talks about authenticity. Everyone here want to be authentic? She says, what does it mean, really? What does authentic mean? Because it's a little bit of a buzzword, like purpose and disruption. And so forth. But she said, what about being authentic to your future self? Isn't that great? Because she had some examples. For example, somebody's just been promoted and they're leading a team, and they go, oh, I don't know really what to do. I haven't done this before. Oh, dear. And she's saying, for the sake of your team, you've got to put on a slightly different pair of shoes.
Of being in control, yes.
Play a little role that may help them. Not because you're saying, look at me, but for their sake, you've got to slightly step up. It's a little bit fake it till you make it, but she did things like had examples of where somebody just saw a good leader and thought, well, shall I have a go at that? Mm. And it worked. And for the sake of their team, and indeed for their own development, they became a better leader. Mm. And I often say, so there are some people here who are not as old as me. There are some people here who might be in their teens. And I'm pretty much the same I was when I was 15, except I'm not. I've been influenced by those people you asked me about. I've learned a lot. But I'm essentially the same.
Yes.
I wouldn't want to decry that person, but he's done some very stupid things. Mm-hmm. That young man and that middle-aged man. I'm always thinking, oh, thank goodness I don't do that anymore. And I realised that was what I did the other day.
Yes, exactly.
I've done some very stupid things.
My dad is still with us and is famous for saying that inside every old person is a young person wondering what the has happened.
Yeah, we're all a work in progress. And I meet such wise teenagers and such wise 20-year-olds and such foolish 60-year-olds like me. Anyway, so she talked, and she's got a book called Act Like a Leader, Think Like a Leader. Act like a leader, think like a leader. That's the wrong way around, isn't it? Because most of the way we see the world here in the West, philosophically, is think and then act. Whereas in other traditions, it's by doing we learn, by doing we think.
Yes.
She talks about act like a leader, think like a leader. So an example was her. She was at Harvard and found that people didn't really like her lectures. She didn't enjoy it. And somebody just came and sat, a friend said, and he said, just a tiny thing, just walk about a bit, go in amongst them. And it just gave her the power. Mm-hmm. That physical thing of owning the space, checking up, are they actually writing things or are they on Tinder? Are the students really doing and doing what they ought? And just by moving about, that tiny tweak gave her confidence internally.
Yes.
So that sometimes the external can affect the internal.
Has she been a mentor to you in helping you write your books as well?
Well, certainly, she's been kind enough to give a good quote, but I borrowed a lot of her research, stuff about... She's looked at how we get on in life, in business, I should say. Yeah. How does a young leader become an experienced leader? How do new leaders stretch themselves? And her thing has generally been, why not try stuff out? Be aware that the identity you have is merely the identity that's kind of grown on you in the decades or the years till now. Mm. It's as much a mantle as what you could in the future. So we're all slightly prisoners of our history. So she's kind of saying, yes, you've been defined at the age of 11 or 31 as this. And that's my thing. Mm. Especially, I help people with presentation. And everyone's terrified of presentation, generally. Mm. Because at some point in their life, they stood up and read out their essay and the teacher said, no, Grimes, not very good.
Oh, you were there.
Exactly, yeah. There's somebody kind of giving them, and they hold a moment of bad feedback for a very long time. And I will say, who was that? Well, they know nothing.
It's like an internal depth charge mantra.
Yeah,
which
exactly.
Is always
or I say, they're absolutely right. You're absolutely rubbish. What are you even bothering to do this? Maybe you can get a job where you just sit in the cupboard. And it kind of go, well, actually, I want to do it. Yeah. And I say, well, have you done it? Well, yeah, I did. You know, I did a best man speech, a best girl speech. Did you rehearse? Yeah, I rehearsed it like Billy-O. Well, why not for this? Oh, right. Oh, yeah. Mm. And I said, why did you do it for your friend? Because it mattered. I said, doesn't this matter?
Yes, interesting.
So
yes.
Put the energy in. So things like that. So Herminia, to me, she represents business academia, which is lots of people are professors of business who write books that don't necessarily have any application to real life. She does.
Yeah.
It's real research on real people. She follows them through. And she was very open to me, with my completely different world, to coming in to teaching some of her students who were very successful business people, but I come in with a slightly different slant. And then they came to the Comedy Store. And even now, I get net messages on LinkedIn. I remember the session you did at London Business School. I even met her at the Comedy Store Players. Wasn't that joyous?
And just say her name one more time. Because it's quite...
Dr. Herminia Ibarra. So like Herman, yes, so Hermin, Ia, Ibarra. So Barra as in Barra, Barra Clough. I'm trying to think of a, as in Barracuda. There we go.
Oh, you're improvising
Herminia, Ibarra, Ibarracuda. So Herminia, I'm going to keep going. Herminia, so her as in pronoun. Minia as in minium, but female, Minia. Ibsen.
You were Herminia.
And then Barra, Barracuda.
Yes.
Herminia, actually, she has a quote on the back of my book, which is called In the Moment, available from all good shops.
You showed us the back cover, which wasn't so impressive there. You need to show the front cover.
The front cover is Mike Myers. The back cover is Herminia Ibarra and other wonderful people.
Lovely. Round of applause, please. And now, moving along, this is a bit of a cashier number two, please, when we sort of got into a nice little, it was a beautiful rabbit hole we were in. But now we're on to the two, what are your squirrels? You know, what are the two monsters of distraction that are never going to, that never fail to distract you, irrespective of anything else that's going
well,
on?
Well, in my head, I was walking past something and I couldn't stop. I had to stop and couldn't go on. That was sort of how I pictured it when you described it to others. And I can't go by a cricket match without stopping. I just have to see at least one ball. It could be just kids in the street. It could be the village green. It could be on the telly and the test match. I just need to see how's it shaping up. What's the bowler like? Fast? Oh, that was a good one. Whistle past the wicket gloves.
Yes,
or just, you know, it's a stick and a tennis ball in the most unusual environment. I just have to stop and see. And I'm looking. How's it going? That's a thing.
That's a great squirrel.
I can't walk past.
Yeah.
And I also can't walk past a sushi shop without thinking.
Oh, you said you had some sushi on
the
way here.
Yeah, I went
you walked past one, obviously.
I went to Yo Sushi by the station here in Bath, and then there was Itsu, and my goodness, I was.
Have you been in both?
I haven't, because I was like, I should have done that. I do love sushi. And when I first had sushi, it was incredibly expensive. It's in posh restaurants, posh hotels, and then Yo Sushi came along and popularized it with the it was on a little conveyor belt, and then it became more available through Wasabi and Itsu. I'm hoping they're going to sponsor me, where it was sort of reasonably priced, because at that stage I was gluten-free, so I couldn't eat bread, and meals on the run were either chips, not very healthy, or sushi. So I do love sushi. A really good tuna or salmon sashimi is I was almost going to go sexual then, but it's just a beautiful feeling. And so I can't, I'm thinking, well, when is dinner? Have I just had lunch? I can have another meal now, can't I? That's my sort of, I can't resist.
Delicious, wonderful squirrel. So I like, in your life, a lot of fish have to die to make you happy. In my life, a lot of chickens have to die.
Is that right?
Yes. I eat a lot of chicken. So now we're on to one quirky or unusual fact about you, Neil Malarkey. We couldn't possibly know about you until you tell us.
Well, I wonder, you won't know that I qualified as an actual table tennis umpire.
Oh!
A gasp of horror.
I love ping pong and I could probably...
Ping pong, dear, please. dear.
I could still beat you, though, that's what
really?
I mean. Yes.
We're going to take you back on that. Okay.
Come on.
So there was a teacher at my school who ran the tuck shop, but also ran the table tennis club and was the referee of the English Open Table Tennis Championships.
Ooh.
And then at the World Table Tennis Championships in 1977 at the Birmingham NEC. And who was his assistant? Moi.
Wow.
And so all the umpires had this kind of lovely blue blazer that John Collier made specially. And my mum knitted me a pullover in that self-same colour.
I love
so
that.
So that would be sort of official. So anyway, Mr. Wright, he was called.
Yeah.
We had table tennis Friday evenings, Saturday mornings. He got in the England number two women's table tennis champion, Carenza Matthews, to come and coach us. And I realised I wasn't going to play for England. I played in a men's league and was pretty good in the schoolboy championships, represented my school, played against somebody who thrashed me and then went to become the national champion. So I thought, it was kind of get to these events, not as a player, but as an umpire. So he had got us as ball boys doing the scoreboard, and then I qualified as an umpire. So there was a written test and there's an actual...
Wow.
You had to umpire a county match. And
so would you say you're very handy with a bat then?
I'm handy with the bat, yeah.
So we should bring this on.
We should bring this on.
I very well, one of my more famous stories is that I was once at JP Morgan giving a talk, and I said, I'm Chris Grimes, I can help you communicate better, and I can probably beat you at ping pong. Then I got on with the talk. 45 minutes later, somebody put their hand up. I thought it was going to be some salient question about pace, pitch, you know, resonance, whatever. And he went, I'll give you a game. And then there was a break that happened. We went outside. I beat him, we went back in, everybody knew, and I slept really well that night.
Was it a proper table?
It was, everything was proper.
Did you have your bat?
Yes, I travelled with it in my bag.
Do you? Because mostly bats that are free are rubbish, aren't they? They don't have enough sponge on them.
And by the way, your lovely character, L. Vaughan Spencer, I was really enjoying. It's Don't Be Needy, Be Succeedy. I know you know this, but you said of him, his biography, is that he studied the philosophy of table tennis and antisocial French at the University of the Isle of Wight, is what you said about.
Yes, so I do this character who's kind of a provocative therapy writ large. His motto is, don't be needy, be succeedy. So he's a motivational guru from near Luton, and he's everything I daren't admit that I am. He's full of himself and a terrible failure, but he pretends that he can help other people be succeedy. So he goes around saying, I can help you, yeah, you're a loser, and that kind of stuff. And then you gradually get a window on his life, which is sad and lonely. Because a lot of these motivational speakers, they're telling you how to run your life or business, and they're not...
They're in their own car crash.
Sort of, yes. Yeah. And so I love playing this character. I put on a ponytail and a little goatee and an orange suit, and I can be the devil. And it's really, as any actor will tell you, it's great fun to play a villain, except he's a sado villain, really.
And he's got his own book, hasn't he, Mr.
It's called Don't Be Needy, Be Succeedy, yeah.
I see what you did there. So, you reincorporated. That's good.
He does motivational raps. Yo, I is not J-Lo. I is Elvo. I is the badass cyber coach. I is the shaman for the layman. It's a no-brainer. I'm your management trainer. Think of me as a safe container. I is your tutor for the future. I hope it suits you. I do alchemy from the balcony of your psyche. My mission is the fruition of intuition. My mission is your lack of ambition. Yo, I is not J-Lo.
Very good. Oh, and by the way, you've given me a delicious segue because you just mentioned the word alchemy. Which
I did, didn't I? I was
so
realised.
We're now going to talk, as moving it along, please. Cashier number 17, please. We're now talking about alchemy and gold.
Yes.
You're giving me this by the bucket load anyway, but when you're at purpose and in flow, Neil Malarkey, what are you absolutely happiest doing?
I think I'm happiest running a workshop with people for a day. Actually, I'm happiest round the table with my family. Is that allowed?
You can have two lovely answers there.
So, my two children and my wife, we just laugh.
Yes.
And it's wonderful. And we had that with my family. And so that's my real happiest.
How long ago did your father die?
My father died of Parkinson's disease 7 years ago.
Right.
Died with Parkinson's. It's probably the more proper way to say it. So we had that with three boys, my mum and dad. We just laughed. And that's my favourite thing. But I'll carry on with what I was going to say. I find a lot of families don't eat together. And we make a big thing of it.
Mm.
And which means my children eat vegetables. Because they see us eating
and
vegetables.
And a lot of sushi if you're cooking.
My wife hates sushi.
Uh-huh.
So that's another reason why I can't go by, because it's like she doesn't like Indian food either. So any opportunity I have to these illicit foods, these contrabands, when I'm not in the family environment, I'll go for. So we sit around, we laugh, and that is my joy. That's when I'm
truly
home.
How old are your children?
They're 14 and 18.
Wonderful.
But we've always eaten together, even when there were 14 and 18 minutes. So professionally is doing a workshop. I introduce people to this beautiful gold, which is improv. Well, you don't know, but if you trust the process, you listen to your fellow player, you build on what they give you, beautiful things happen. Stories emerge, humour happens, laughter. The quietest person becomes a funny person, not because they're doing gags, but because they're open and they're enjoying the vulnerability. And I get to know them in a day. So that's what I love. My sort of at home life, being around the table, I don't have to rush somewhere. None of us has to go and do homework upstairs, which sometimes, you know, weekdays. So it's a weekend probably.
Is it a circular table? So you've even got a theatre in the round going on with
the
comedy.
We really want a lazy Susan. I have to tell you, I'd like a lazy Susan. We don't have it. We just pass it. We actually bought a house
What is a lazy Susan? Sorry.
It's you know, in a mostly Chinese restaurants, but other places.
Ah, yes.
It's a roundy thing. Oh. You put it on the thing and you send the rice round.
Yes.
And then if you can have fun by sending it too fast. But you take a little bit of rice.
That
you
centrifugal
send it
rice.
The centrifugal thing. It's called I don't know why it's called a lazy Susan. Maybe Susan was lazy. But we'd like one of them. We have a square table because the people we bought the house from somebody and they said, this table's too big to get out. It was actually made in the house. Can you buy it?
They were old boat builders. Well,
actually, it's a sculpture and a piece of granite.
Oh, wow.
So it was stuck together in the house.
Yes.
So to get it out, you'd have to break it, which is virtually impossible.
And you're going to convert that to a lazy Susan?
We want one on top. So we pass it round. Yes. There. Anyway, it was funny because they said, can you buy this table? I said, yeah, all right. And they said, this is what we paid for it. Oh, right. You don't get a discount? No. We love it. It's lovely because you can put hot things on
yes,
it.
Straight
marble.
Down.
It's been absolutely wonderful. So that round the table, then running a workshop with people I get to know who are slightly scared of my world.
Yeah.
And then by the end, they're lapping it up and they're saying, I want to be a comedian. I want to do improv for the rest of my life.
Marvellous answer. And I'm right there with you. So now I'm going to award you with a cake, please, Mr. Malarkey. So this is where you get to put a cherry on the cake. First of all, do you like cake? You like sushi?
I like cake very much. In my gluten-free days, I would scour the world for gluten-free cake. And there is plenty of options. Polenta cake, you know.
And you said when you were gluten-free.
Yes.
Have you moved past that and you're now back on the gluten
turbo? I'm back. I just eat gluten, you know, I mainline gluten.
Yeah.
I was off wheat, gluten and dairy. So
what put you back on it? Because normally when you're off it, you're off it.
I got better.
Oh. Marvellous. So we're going to give you a cake of choice then. So what flavour cake do we want specifically? Polenta? Or you want to go
No, I think I might go... I might go Victoria Sponge.
Would you like to
I'll tell you what I'm going to go. It's my family, my children, have learned to make a brilliant courgette cake.
Ooh.
That sounds boring, doesn't it?
It does sound boring.
It's basically banana cake with a little bit of courgette in. So it's really moist and tasty. The courgette is kind of shredded, and you've got some bananas in there, and it's just joyous.
It shall be yours. And then this is the final storytelling metaphor, where now you get to put a cherry on the cake, and this is stuff like, and we'll do it one at a time, what's your favourite inspirational quote that's always given you sucker and pulled you towards your future?
Always given me? Well, this afternoon I realised I hadn't got one.
So I thought,
there's that one the other day. So it's interesting because in December, I'm going to do a charity event at the Comedy Store called My Big Fail, where we get people who are very successful to talk about how they made a hash of things. We did it last year, and it was a great success. We had people from business, from the third sector, and so forth. Just that thing of, I made a hash of it. And it's such a wonderful thing to purge that. And so I was preparing this for an event I did recently for an innovation festival, because failure is very much part of creativity. Of innovation. So this is from B.F. Skinner, who was a psychologist about conditioning. You know Pavlov's, the dogs?
Yeah.
So he would get, there's food, he'd ring the bell, they come and have the food every day for some time, and then at some point, they would salivate because there was food. At some point, there was no food, you just rang the bell, and they started salivating.
I'll see if I can make you think of sushi.
It's called operant conditioning.
Yeah.
So when I was at university, I wrote a whole essay about why men and women were different because of operant conditioning. That girls are put in pink and boys are put in blue. Boys are given guns, girls are given dolls. And I got a very low mark. Because I hadn't really...
You're ahead of your time.
Well,
sort of.
No, I think there's more to it than that,
yes,
dare I say.
Shall we say.
And I just read a chapter on it, and it was the Ladybird book of opera. Anyway, so B.F. Skinner was that we get conditioned. We get so used to certain things. Anyway, the quote's really quite irrelevant to who he was. he says, a failure is not always a mistake. It may simply be the best one can do under the circumstances. The real mistake is to stop trying.
Love that.
I like that, yeah. So I keep trying and I let myself off. I'm pretty forgiving of myself. That's what I did at the time. It wasn't perfect, but
yes,
at the time that's what I knew. That's all I could do.
Love
and
that.
Improv teaches you that. No improv show is perfect. No improv sketch is perfect.
Yeah, the shares go up and down in an improv show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you come away, and I say to people, they say, were we good? Well, how was it? And I say, we generally, between 8 and 9.5 out of 10. We never get to 10, just because that's the nature of it.
Yes.
And I love that in some faiths, when they build a temple, they always put an imperfection in, deliberately to show that only God is perfect. Mm. Human beings are not perfect. We're flawed, so let's embrace them.
Allowing a bit of nice, juicy silence there. What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
The best piece of advice? I really struggle with this, and I'm struggling now. Actually, it might be my wife. When I was thinking about doing an MBA, I was thinking about stopping doing the Comedy Store Players, so I could. And this was after I'd come back and I had my sabbatical. And I said, maybe I'll go and live in Bath, for example. What a beautiful city. Isn't it really lovely? I was just walking through it this afternoon. Mm. This is, it turns out also my grandparents are buried in Bath.
Oh, right. Gosh.
As it happens, because my father grew up in what was then probably Somerset. So I love Bath. So the chance to go and study in Bath was too much to resist. In the end, I did. And she said, do you really want to give up the Comedy Store Players? That's the one thing you love. All the rest, with auditions and reading a script and thinking I should audition for this, I've been told to by my agent, it'll help my career, but it's really not a very nice script. So he just said, don't give up the Comedy Store Players. And that was the best piece of advice.
It's like a factory default setting, which I'm understanding you're bringing to the equation. Even your book, In the Moment, it's the idea of being present to just let's be in the now and see what happens. So
yeah.
I love the, I mean, similarly, whenever I do an Instant Wit Show, that's like a factory default reset as well. So that's very relatable. What advice, notes, would you proffer to a younger version of yourself?
I suppose it would be nothing is forever, especially mistakes. Any decision you make, it can lead to something else. So the choices you make are not final until you die. and that may happen tonight. Maybe that's... I shall eat my own words. But basically, I wanted to be a doctor when I was doing my A-levels. I wanted to be... go to Cambridge, and I got to Cambridge. I thought I'd be somebody who'd write and perform sketches.
Yes.
And I realised improv was the thing that I loved. I thought I'd spend most of my time doing showbiz. Mm-hmm. Then along came the idea of working with people. I thought I didn't think I'd have children. I was lucky that that happened. So all things occurred despite what you thought was the final state the continuing state.
Yes.
Nothing is not changeable, to be terribly ungrammatical. Everything can develop and evolve. No decision is final.
Lovely. And now we're ramping up to a bit of Shakespeare in a few moments. And this is a very authentic prop, by the way. This is the actual, not first folio.
The one that he wrote.
No,
yes.
Shakespeare didn't sign it.
Do I have to do some Shakespeare?
No, you can if you like, but it's actually borrowing from All the World's a Stage and All the Men and Women Be Players, and we're going to talk about legacy momentarily.
Yes.
But just before we do that, can I please pass the golden baton, please? So who in your network, now that you know and have experienced this from within, who do you think you'd most like to pass on the golden baton to have an experience like this in the Good Listening To Show?
Well, I think you should ask Ruth Bratt. You won't know who she is, perhaps, or maybe you will, but others may not know. Ruth Bratt is a wonderful performer. If you have seen a TV show called People Do Nothing, an award young people's comedy, it was on BBC Three. Ruth, I'll tell you later. Ruth Bratt. So she plays Roche, short for Rochelle. She's the girlfriend of one of the main characters. They're DJs running this kind of lowbrow radio station. If you travelled on British Airways a few years ago, one of the characters was the one doing that video where he was trying to get Joanna Lumley and others to act, and he was kind of that guy. So she's the girlfriend in that. She's also one of the creators and mainstays of a thing called Showstopper, which is an improvised musical.
Yeah.
Now, despite all I've said about failure, yes, you can do anything, the one thing I can't do is sing yet. Yet. And I was told by somebody, get off the stage, you can't sing, by the musical director of the Cambridge Footlights pantomime, which I was directing.
Get off, you can't sing.
Get off, you can't do singing. And so I could sing in my heart, in my head, so one day I'll learn, but she can do... She's. If you know who Josie Lawrence is, you know, she is an amazing person who's a brilliant, funny improviser, can sing improv songs and like nobody's business. A few years ago, she said, I've done this show in Edinburgh. Ruth Bratt should come and be our guest. And she has guested with us many times. She's also she's part of Showstopper. She's done various things at the Edinburgh Festival, acting, writing. She's in Ricky Gervais's Afterlife. I think she got cut quite a lot, but she still gets paid. That's how it works.
Perfect.
Anyway, so she's, and she's just a wonderful person.
Thank you.
She's got wonderful stories. She, in a few years ago, decided to learn to do pottery. She's brilliant at pottery now. So there you go. Thank you. But just why not? Why wouldn't you? Why not do a thing? Learn to do a thing.
Perfect. Thank you. So now we're on to the Shakespeare, and inspired, as I said, by All the World of Steve, All the Players, how, when all is said and done, Neil Mullarkey, would you most like, and I've got a lovely sound effect I like to do now, how would you most like to be remembered?
Well, I'm going to borrow this from Frank Farrelly.
I'm still doing the sound effect.
We can cut that bit out.
So do you want to hold that too while you're
okay.
doing
Okay. How would I like to remember? I'm going to borrow this from Frank Farrelly, the father of provocative therapy. He said he'd like to be remembered by the words, he made some people laugh sometimes.
Lovely. Where can we find out all about you on the interweb, and particularly where can we go and find out about your book, please?
Okay, yeah, I was going to read out a bit, wasn't I?
You can do that too. We can put it on a metaphorical plinth at this moment.
Okay, well, it was. I feels wrong, though. Anyway, I've told you most of what I was going to say in this bit, but it was. I ran an improv workshop in Bury St Edmunds, and there were agriculture workers, lawyers, and I just realised, teaching them, how much fun this could be and the broader applications. So I talk a little bit about improv. I've got chapters on meetings. Make meetings better, wouldn't we like that? Creativity, collaboration, the human connection. And luckily, I wrote this after the pandemic. Mm. So on those remote hybrid meetings, Teams, Zoom, you can still use improv. You can still have fun. I treat them like an improv game. What's going on in your background? Oh, there's a bicycle. Oh, there's an Amazon delivery man. Oh, there's a... In your case, there'd be a chicken, but there could be a pet.
Long, I'll eat it.
So lots of stuff about how to make... How can you get on better in life and work? Serendipity. How we don't embrace serendipity in organisations, whereas in theatre and art, we do all the time. Mm. Something happened by chance. Oh, that's good. Keep it in. So the book is called In the Moment. Basically, it's how we to use some improv skills, so thinking on your feet and so forth, adapting, working with somebody else, and also I have my cake and eat it. There's times when you need to be fully prepared, organised, when doing a presentation, for example, or a meeting where there needs an agenda, there's not much time, you've got to get the budget sorted. There's plenty of time you've got to prepare, but also the moment could be the moment, in an improv moment, 2-3 seconds, but also the moment, as I may have implied in my story, that 6 months where you thought, actually, what is it I want to do? That year, that 5 years, where slowly a dawning comes upon you. And a moment can be something you look back on and realise it was a moment in history. And so basically saying to people, when are the moments that need to be prepared and when are the moments you need to borrow the skills of ne'er-do-wells improvisers like us? So it's called In the Moment. You can get it on Amazon, Kogan Page, Waterstones, W.H. Smith. But neilmullarkey.com is how people get hold of me. Yeah. I'm on Instagram, Neil Mullarkey. I'm on Twitter, Neil Mullarkey. I'm on Threads.
Oh, go you.
Neil Mullarkey.
And with a name like Mullarkey, you were born for a life in showbiz and titting about,
well,
basically.
Tell that to my brothers. One's an accountant, one's a chemical engineer. And my mum was a maths teacher. So
you've got away with the Mullarkey.
She wasn't born a Mullarkey, but... So, yes, it wasn't nominative determinism. I stepped out a little bit of the family route. But, of course, we all have to find who we are, in a way. So people did think it was it was a made-up name, but it's my real name. If I knew you better, I'd show you my credit cards.
As this has been your moment in the sunshine, in the Good Listening To show, Stories and Distinction of Genius, is there anything else you'd like to say before we go into a bit of a segue into an audience Q&A? So is there anything else you'd like to say at this point?
No, I'd say thank you for having me. Isn't he great?
Thank you.
And thank you. Thank you to everyone in Facebook and YouTube land for listening, if you have. You may have turned off by 10 minutes ago. And to everyone here, you've been so generous. Thank you very much. And we'll answer some questions.
We'll give you a huge round of applause in a moment. But now we'll move on to a Q&A if you'd like to do that. So what questions might you have for our illustrious guest, Neil Mullarkey?
Oh, well, there's a microphone.
And everything.
And everything.
Are there... Oh, yes, yes, yes. Thank you. I'm going to come among the people. There you are. Johnny.
Oh, good evening.
Does it work?
Where does that saying, I can't be doing with all that malarkey, come from?
Thank you. I did a show called All That Malarkey. If you don't know this, sometimes you say, all that malarkey, all that nonsense, all, and there's that phrase, all that malarkey. It's not spelt my way. It's M-A-L-A-R-K-Y. I looked at this, and there's nobody actually knows. So I did a show called All That Malarkey. So anybody called malarkey, I said, you can come for free, whatever the spelling is. And I'd looked in the phone book in London, small fringe theatre, probably even smaller than this, and so... I said, there's about 10 malarkeys in London. 25 people turned up, you know, quarter of the audience probably. And their maiden names, whatever, they had birth certificates. Oh, they said, we're ex-directory. So, and there were architects and the people, all sorts of walks of life. So we don't actually know. There were various things, if you look on the internet. It could be that there were some builders in New Jersey. It seemed to be that this phrase only came to be in common parlance in the 1920s and started in America. Maybe there were some malarkeys, which is an Irish name, who were builders who give an IOU that was worthless. This is a load of malarkey. Somebody says it's from the word lark, larking around, so sorry, I can't help.
That's a very good answer, though.
Thank you.
You didn't know. That's very good. Anybody else have a question, please? Yes.
Do you still have the umpire's jumper made for you? Oh,
lovely question.
I don't, and I remember giving it away because I grew out of it, and that's very sad. It is sad, yeah. I don't, but I have my mum's love and my love for her, and she's 91 now, so she can't. One of her biggest regrets, she can't knit like she used to, but she's still a demon with the jigsaws. But she knitted everything so much for a long, long time. This is going to get sort of soppy, but she bought a doll for when my niece visited, who's older than my children, and whenever my niece visited, the doll would come out, and my mum knitted stuff. My son was born 3 weeks premature, was very, very small, and we didn't have clothes that were small enough for him, but my mum had bequeathed this doll and the clothes to my daughter, and they fitted my son. Oh. So he could wear, because he was born very premature, very small, and to keep him warm, he had to wear a bonnet, little boy. And the bonnet from the doll kept him warm because, his stomach was tiny and he had to keep warm. Otherwise, he'd go all purple.
And that's wonderful.
It is wonderful, isn't it?
That was wonderful. Anybody else for a question, please? Yes, we've got at least two more, which is very exciting. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Did you play cricket? And what was your favourite cricketing moment?
I did play cricket. I was always good in the nets. But in the middle, when the actual game, I was a bit rubbish. I used to play in a comedian's team. So Arthur Smith, you might have heard of Arthur Smith. So he'd have a team versus a team run by my friend Chris England. So if anyone's seen a play called An Evening with Gary Lineker, it was written by Chris England and Arthur Smith. So it was Chris... it was Arthur Smith versus An England 11, because it was Chris England. And every year there'd be a prize giving in the pub for most amusing moments. And there was always a prize for best catch while smoking a cigarette. And Andy Smart won it regularly. On the boundary. There we go. So those are my favourite cricketing moments. And Bill Bailey used to play, Hugh Grant... it was fun just to have those Sunday afternoons where nothing really mattered. We were all a bit rubbish. Bill Bailey was a mean fast bowler, by the way. So, yes, Andy Smart catching the ball while smoking a cigarette.
Wonderful, thank you.
But kids, don't smoke.
Next question.
Sorry, good evening. You've highlighted the values of improvisation skill and the relevance of it. Does the comedy bit become a big pressure?
No, because actually the initial thing of improv was not comedy. It was social work, and then it became theatre. How do we make theatre? How do we make stories? And fairly easily, comedy just was an easy byproduct. So if you've seen the Comedy Store Players, and I urge you to come, and see us. But there's lots of improv, instant wit. Go and see an improv show. Then you'll know that the comedy just arrives through the trust and the vulnerability. Sounds awfully soppy, doesn't it? But I'm at the Comedy Store. The audience has paid to laugh. So there is a bit of pressure, but it's exactly the right pressure. It's like a sushi chef being asked, can you make sushi? That's what we do.
Make comedy sushi.
Make comedy sushi. We do funny things. We can't help it, and it's not always on purpose. There is a thing sometimes, we call it gagging. When somebody inserts a joke to a sketch that spoils it, it's funny how it's frowned upon. And gagging is both a joke, but also stopping somebody else speak. So the pressure is very light. The pressure is very light. The only time there is a pressure is sometimes the Wednesdays before Christmas, you used to get office parties who didn't realise that what we're doing is quite fragile. That on stage, if they're muttering, do you want a beer? Who wants a lager? Is all right, Dave? That's really off-putting. That's the worst kind of heckle. If somebody shouts out, chicken, that's fine. Oh, yes, of course I'm a chicken. That's fine, we can play with it. But if there's a general hubbub. So yes, there is a bit of pressure, but it's fine. It's good pressure. It means that we don't worry if there isn't a laugh every 30 seconds, which stand-up comedians might, because we know that actually what's happening is the story. Lay the foundations of the story, and then humour comes later, like sitcoms, I dare say.
Wonderful. Are we done with questions, do we think? So, just a quick announcement. Thank you for being here also on Facebook and YouTube. And yes, check out the website for the show as well. I didn't show you that, by the way. Squirrels, there will be squirrels. And apparently they do that when they're looking at a really precious bunch of nuts. Thanks for coming. So this is next, Rosie Cavaliero. More squirrels coming. So look at the website, which is www.thegoodlisteningtoshow.com. By being in the show, you also get to be on UK Health Radio, where there's an audience reach globally of about 1.2 million across 54 countries. Woo-hoo-hoo-hoo! So check it out. And if you want to be in the show too, there are a number of series strands as to how you can do that. So if you've written a good book, for example, or you might want to talk about, you know, what you do and get an audience to be really clear where to go and find out all about you, then that is where you should go, goodlisteningtoshow.com. So, ladies and Jen Min, would you like to say anything else, lovely man?
No, thank you so much, everyone. Thank you, Chris. Thank you to everyone who's been doing the stuff to make sure that the people on the live stream are watching this as well. Thank you.
Thank you for that segue, too. And I'd just like to sincerely thank the wonderful Chris and Pete from Spiralux, who have done all of this. I walked into Spiralux looking for someone to help stream, and then by a brilliant coincidence, Chris was someone I used to supply teach when I was in the wilderness years of being an actor at Filton High School. And he didn't quite do this, but he was like, oh, all right, Mr. Grimes. And then he was keen to help me from that point on. So he's an absolute legend. So can I have a quick round of applause for them? And again, and Pete as well. Ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to the Good Listening to Show. Thank you very much indeed, Neil Malarkey! Thank you very much indeed. Good night.
You've been listening to the Good Listening to Show here on UK Health Radio with me, Chris Grimes. Oh, it's my son.
If you've enjoyed the show, then please do tune in next week to listen to more stories from The Clearing.
If you'd like to connect with me on LinkedIn, then please do so. There's also a dedicated Facebook group for the show too. You can contact me about the programme, or if you'd be interested in experiencing some personal impact coaching with me, care of my Level Up Your Impact programme, that's chris@secondcurve.uk. On Twitter and Instagram, it's
@thatchrisgrimes.
So until next time, for me, Chris Grimes, from UK Health Radio, and from Stan,
to your good health.
Goodbye.